Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the first occasional lecture for 2011. It's a very great pleasure today to welcome Professor Jeff Gallop, who's a distinguished academic. He is the director of the Graduate School of Government at the University of Sydney. He also just happened to be Premier of Western Australia in a past life. So there's no one better suited to talk about today's topic, which is the state of federalism in Australia. So please join me in welcoming Professor Jeff Gallop.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. And can I say I'm deeply honoured by your attendance at my lecture today to talk about a subject about which I'm passionate and which formed the basis of my maiden speech, actually, in the Western Australian Parliament back in 1986. So I declare my biases from the beginning, born and bred in rural and regional Western Australia, and a very strong supporter of the system of federalism and the role that the states play in that system. What I would like to do today is nine things. First of all, I'd like to have a very quick look at the ways in which we talk about federalism in Australia. Secondly, and following from that, I'd like to look at how the idea of federalism plays out politically. And I don't think that's an area that we really devote enough attention to. Thirdly, I would like to do a brief overview of how the politics of federalism has actually played out in Australian politics over the 20th century and into the 21st century and has led to the growing power of the Commonwealth. I'd then like to state my own position very, very briefly on why it is that I believe federalism is the best system of government that we can have, not only just for Australia, but generally speaking. I'd then like to look at how the states have tried to reformulate their position in respect of federalism in light of the fact that the Commonwealth has gained more power over time and in light of the fact that the financial power certainly exists in the centre. I'd then like to discuss how this reformulation of the state's position has manifested itself in recent years as cooperative federalism and look at the way in which that system is currently working, to look at the tensions within that system and the ways in which they might resolve themselves in the future. And finally, I'll conclude that federalism does need to go back onto the agenda of Australian politics, but that is unlikely to happen. And so, unfortunately, I think in Australia, the best we can hope will be second best. But let me go to each of these points in turn. There are so many issues related to the discussion of Australian federalism that it's very hard to know where to begin. And in saying this, I'm always reminded of a wonderful story told by Gary Sturgis, formerly government official in New South Wales, about a United Nations committee that was commissioned to look at international studies on the elephant. There was a variety of contributions, each nation giving its own unique insights and expertise. Germany submitted a paper on the training and discipline of elephants. France questioned the existence of elephants. The United Kingdom submitted a paper on the role of the elephant in colonial expansion. There were two papers from the US, one from the East and one from the West. The one from the East, taking over elephants, economies of scale and synergistic benefits. The one from the West, the joy of elephants. Australia submitted a paper, elephants, federal or state responsibility. And I think that tells us immediately that this question of roles and responsibilities has always been close to the heart of any discussion of federalism. What does the Constitution say? And how has this changed over the years, either through constitutional interpretation by the High Court or through referenda? And, of course, in recent years, we've had the notion floated that we should have another constitutional convention looking at these roles and responsibilities, an idea that's been mooted but not delivered in practice. Linked to this discussion, of course, is the question of intergovernmental relations and how they're managed, including, of course, in relation to overseas treaties and trade agreements. Under this heading, we see an assessment of the role and functioning of a range of institutions set up to facilitate cooperation between the levels of government, most importantly, but not only, the Council of the Australian Governments. Thirdly, there's the matter of Commonwealth state finance and the taxing powers of each level of government. And of course, this immediately takes us into the territory of vertical fiscal imbalance, the situation where the revenue-raising powers and expenditure responsibilities of each level of government are mismatched. A distinguishing feature of our federation is the very high level of vertical fiscal imbalance, with the Commonwealth, of course, being in the dominant position. Fourthly, there has been substantial analysis of the governmental institutions that reflect our commitment to federalism. Most notably, the Senate, the High Court, and of course the states themselves. It's interesting that we contrast the position of the states with the territories, and I think that immediately gives us a feel for how federalism makes a difference and how a federal system of government would be different from a unitary system of government with regional institutions backing it up. Inevitably, any discussion about significant proposals such as the Charter of Rights and the recent Brennan Report, or the Republic through the Constitutional Convention we had in the 1990s, immediately gets caught up in this discussion about federal institutions such as the states, the Senate, and the role that they play in the system. Fifthly, of course, we examine how each of these issues all comes together to form an Australian model. It's a linguistic playground. Managerial federalism, intelligent federalism, opportunistic federalism, cooperative federalism. How do we define the nature of our system here in Australia? On the other hand, some say we should tell it for what it is: creeping centralism. In discussing this issue, we usually find that there's a prescriptive element as well as a descriptive element. In particular, an analysis of the public policy implications of the different ways to distribute powers, raise taxes, and cooperate in matters of mutual concern, as well as manage differences that arise from time to time within the Federation. Now, when this discussion takes place, we immediately get into the province of values and ideology. Federalism is a subject about which politicians and commentators have a view, for or against. Do we need change, or should we leave the system as it is? Now, I think we need to note, as a statement of fact, that such views aren't necessarily evidence-based, to use a modern term from public policy. They're often a mixture of what I call pride and prejudice. In other words, those advocating for federalism usually find themselves located in the states, and those against it usually find themselves located here in Canberra. So is the advocate a federal or a state politician? That will affect the way they look at this issue. Is the advocate a state or Commonwealth public servant? And that will also influence the way they look at the issue. There's pride associated with government. There's pride for those working in state government, pride for those working in the Commonwealth government. From that pride flows prejudice. And those prejudices are part and parcel of the makeup of Australian federalism. This leads me to my sixth and final way in which the issue can be analysed, and a way that's not often taken up in the literature. What's the politics related to this idea of federalism? What are the limits of change at any particular point in time? Who are the participants in that debate? What power and influence do they have in determining outcomes? How do they mobilise and shape opinion about federalism? And most importantly, what is the attitudes of the public to these matters? Do they see federalism as just another way of delivering services and what really matters is the outcomes? Or do they see federalism as something they want to protect and promote within our body politic? The latter view, of course, was very well demonstrated by former Prime Minister John Howard when in a speech on the 20th of August 2007 he said, I quote, "So much of the debates about Commonwealth-state relations concerns the respective roles of the two levels of government, as if an appropriate balance were an end in itself. To me, that misses the point. We should be neither centralist nor slavish adherents to states' rights. We should be focused on outcomes, not systems." So it's very important to see how that view plays out in the public arena. These matters are very important. They're particularly important for reformers because they help in determining what may or may not be possible by way of change. At any time, there are forces working for change, and of course, there are forces working against change. And of course, they win or lose, not just on the basis of the particular strength they might have, or indeed on the basis of the strength of the arguments they have and the evidence for their arguments, but also on how the politics plays out at any point in time. Let me illustrate this. Labor's proposals at the last election, the election in 2007, given the title Cooperative Federalism, may not have been so well received if John Howard's authority had not been so badly dented by complacency on climate change and aggression, on industrial relations. So the circumstances play a role in all of this, and they open up space or they close off space for those who wish to change the system, either be through pushing it in a centralist direction or pushing it more in a federalist direction. Let me give a very, very brief overview of the politics of Australian federalism from the vantage point of 20th century history. It's very clear, and we all know this, that the Commonwealth has been the winner. Not only is it a case that a mixture of wartime necessity and constitutional interpretation have pushed the balance of power in the direction of the Commonwealth, there has always been an ideological current favouring centralisation in the Australian body politic. It's seen as better for economic planning, better for economic efficiency, and good public policy. Not surprisingly, such a view has strong roots in Canberra and has often been associated with the assumed requirements of national sovereignty in a competitive world. Having just recently read the first edition of the new biography of Gough Whitlam, you see very clearly this view, represented by his father as well as by himself, that Canberra has a civilising mission within Australia. And it comes through very, very strongly. Now, in earlier times in Australian history, this view was linked very much with a democratic socialist point of view, that the will of the majority, that is, the will of the majority of the Australian people, should prevail when confronted with the checks and balances we associate with liberalism, such as upper houses like the Senate and the High Court, which places a constraint on the powers of government, or with conservatism, such as property franchises or malapportionment. So the democratic socialist view, a large part of the Australian 20th century, was that federalism was anti-democratic. So in this mix of views, federalism was seen as an enemy of the creation of a united nation with one set of laws applying to all. Noting, of course, that it took some time before all meant everyone, including our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population, and including those of a different racial background. So for a large part, the left side of politics was opposed to federalism and favoured moves to a unitary system. In more recent times, there's been a fascinating shift on the conservative side of politics. The conservative side of politics has taken on the view that uniformity is better for business. And it's also better for our more mobile population. So too is centralisation seen as better to protect our geographical and cultural borders against minorities, intent on undermining traditional Australian values associated with which have been taken up in terms of, quote, the postmodern curricula and libertarian attitudes that have come through at state level. So this has been a fascinating development. Initially, federalism was very much seen as an enemy by the left, and in more recent years has been seen as an enemy by the right. Whilst this development of the right-wing side of Australian politics has opened up space for Labor to embrace federalism, there still remains a very strong residue of centralism within the federal Labor caucus. This is partly a case of position. In other words, they're in the Commonwealth Parliament, but also of ideology. That is to say, Labor now has a strong commitment at the national level to, quote, a streamlined system of regulation in Australia. On how state Labor has responded to this new situation, I will have something to say later in my talk. But I want to start with this observation. There has always been a very heavily valued-based opposition to the federal principle within Australian politics. Firstly from the left, and more recently from the right. Taking turns, the left and the right have lined up with the federal bureaucracy to seek more power for the Commonwealth. This mixture of ideology and brute power has proved very effective in undermining and quite often overriding the states and certainly the territories when they express a point of view or pass legislation or propose legislation which is seen as against the Australian interest. Both Labor and Liberal governments have been involved in this process that has led to a power shift in Australian politics. Let me give one example from very recent times. It was the Commonwealth seeking power to exclude state-based conciliation and arbitration and consolidate work choices that precipitated the New South Wales challenge in the High Court, and of course backed by the other states, including my own Western Australia. This resulted in a very expansive definition of the corporation's power in section 5120 of the Constitution. And many would have said, no one should have been surprised by that. It goes way back to the engineer's case and has continued through. Try as they might, the states were unable to convince the court. They tried argument after argument that there were clear limits to the exercise of that corporation's power. Only Justices Kirby and Callanan pointed to the need to read the Constitution as a whole and to be mindful of preserving a balance between the two levels of government. And they were very strong in their views. In fact, Callanan said the implication of this decision may very well be that the state parliaments become debating chambers rather than real centres of political power. Now, one would have thought that they were right in terms of what the founders of the Constitution intended. However, as has so often been the case in Australian history, each head of power in the Constitution has been accorded full scope on the basis of the language rather than any theory of balance within government. So the Commonwealth knows that it can push the boundaries in its lawmaking functions. Whatever the political colouring of the Commonwealth government, Labor or Coalition, it is always tempted to do this and urged to do it by a public service that is proud of its status and openly contemptuous of the lower levels of government. Usually it starts out like this. There's an issue. That issue becomes a national issue, which needs a national solution. And as time flows on, the national solution becomes a Commonwealth initiative. And if necessary, the legislative power is gained and often supported by the High Court to make this happen. Having said all of that about the way in which Australian federalism has played out in the 20th century and the 21st century, what are my own views on the subject? Well, I draw your attention to a publication in 2007 by Anne Toomey and Glenn Withers, Australia's Federal Future, commissioned by the Council of Australian Federation, which, of course, is the body set up to protect and promote the interests of state and territory governments in Australia. Toomey and Withers go about their task in a very methodical and very empirical way. Certainly to my mind, and of course my mind was well and truly tuned up to their argument, they demonstrate very clearly the economic, social and political benefits of a federal system of government. Of the debates about federalism in Australia, they have this to say in their covering letter to the Council of the Australian Federation, and I quote, a lengthy quote, "It became apparent to us in writing this report that Australian attitudes towards federalism are out of step with those in the rest of the world. In Australia, it is often asserted that federalism is an old-fashioned, cumbersome and inefficient system. Yet internationally, federalism is regarded as a modern, flexible and efficient structure that is ideal for meeting the needs of local communities when responding to the pressures of globalisation. The difference between these two views is stark. In this report, we've used political, legal and economic analysis and international comparisons to highlight that far from being a burden, Australia's federal system provides us with many economic and social benefits. For example, it divides and limits power, protecting the individual." Remember the debate on the terror legislation, and I was part of it as the Premier of Western Australia. And the states did play a role in limiting the extent of that legislation and making it harder for the Commonwealth Parliament to just change it at will. And of course, there's still a limitation, there's still a division of power within the Constitution itself. But I digress. Back to the quote. "It gives Australians a wide range of choices and allows policies and services to be tailored to meet the needs of communities. It spurs all Australian governments to be more innovative and responsive. Compared to centralised unitary government, federal nations such as Australia have more efficient government and higher rates of economic growth and higher per capita GDP. These benefits deliver significant economic and social advantages to all Australians. However, increasing centralisation in Australia threatens these benefits." So that's an academic study of federations with a strong conclusion that federalism works better than unitary systems of government. Let me take those arguments and try and underpin them with some analysis. The truth about government, and certainly from my experience, is that no one level of government can be expected to get it right all the time. There are good and bad Commonwealth governments. There are good and bad state and territory governments. And for that matter, there are good and bad local governments. Somehow or another, a range of commentators seem to think that increasing the power of the Commonwealth will automatically mean a lesser involvement of vested interests in the process and, quote-unquote, a more rational outcome in terms of public policy. Unfortunately, however, this is not the case. Rationality in Australia doesn't reside in one particular level of government as against another. It's everywhere or nowhere or somewhere or partly there. Rationality is not a safe assumption to make about politics anywhere in Australia. At all levels of government, governments are subject to political pressure on issues like economic and environmental reform. Let me give you one example. The Water Act 2007 went through the federal parliament. At last, said the Prime Minister and the Minister at the time, we're going to grab hold of this issue and we're going to make sure that the parochialism of the states is cast aside and we get the Murray River working again. Well, all the legislation went through, but now that legislation would appear to be a bit inconvenient to some of the vested interests associated with the environmental health of the Murray-Darling River. Note the debate, the contorted debate that's going on about the meaning of the words in the Murray-Darling legislation. It illustrates only too well that what the Prime Minister of the time called parochialism at state level has just been shifted over to what we might call vested interests at the national level. Politics is always a tough business. It always involves conflicting interests. It's always difficult to get the perfect resolution. Shifting power from one level to another is not necessarily the solution to that particular problem. In more recent times as well, I think we could say we've seen some great failures at Commonwealth level in public administration. So too have we seen failures at state level in public administration. At the same time, we've seen innovation and reform, some coming from above and some coming from below. Much of this has come from state governments. In a recently published speech, Helen Silver, Secretary of the Department of Premier and Cabinet in Victoria, has listed some examples. Case mix funding for public hospitals. Now, given that the federal government is committed to this at a national level through the new agreement, all of that work in Victoria is now going to be very, very useful in facilitating the change. State-based greenhouse gas certification and abatement in New South Wales. The early anti-discrimination legislation in South Australia. And, of course, the Dunstan government back in those times was a very forward-looking government with its legislation, and in many ways led the way to what became the radical agenda of the Whitlam government. We've got the healthcare call centres in Western Australia. About such innovation, she notes this, quote, there are tremendous benefits to be gained from vigorous competition between the states and territories as proven strategies in one jurisdiction are then taken up by others. More controversially, and not yet universalised, are the charters of rights in your own Australian Capital Territory and Victoria, and the medically supervised injecting centre in New South Wales. They sit in contrast, of course, to the euthanasia legislation in the Northern Territory and the civil partnerships legislation in the Australian Capital Territory. Because they were territories, they couldn't sustain their commitment to innovation. On the other hand, the states still have sufficient power in our system to be able to innovate and go in directions that are not yet seen as desirable at a national level. I think that's a good thing, and our society still provides for that diversity. So this leads me to my second point. The first one, there's this strong current in Australian history that's opposed to federalism, that wants to move things towards a unitary system. My second point is this. Even though the position of the states has weakened, they still play an important role in Australian politics, both constitutionally and financially. Number one, they provide important services and advocate for their communities within the boundaries of the state. However limited their powers of revenue raising are, they still have revenue raising powers. They're facilitators of development within a national and a global context. If I may just add, I always used to like to see Western Australia as a state within the Federation and a region within the global economy. Now, I know that foreign policy and trade policy is set by the Commonwealth Government, but that doesn't mean a state can't be active in promoting its interests around the world as both WA and Queensland have done, through a very, very strong set of overseas offices, many of which are criticised by economic rationalists as being a waste of money. But certainly, from a state point of view, they've been very proactive in bringing business and therefore jobs to Western Australia and Queensland. Note too that the federal system has provided for displays of difference. Western Australia, daylight saving, can't get up despite those referenda. Sunday trading, the evangelicals are still winning over in Western Australia. And of course, we don't have poker machines in hotels or clubs in Western Australia. Now, these are real differences. And I think it's good to have an Australia where these sorts of differences can exist. We have a complex set of power relations, unlike those that apply in a unitary system. A very good illustration of this complexity is the national reform agenda. What is the national reform agenda? To my mind, it's the states trying to reformulate federalism so that they can play a role, even though they work within the context of vertical fiscal imbalance. Where did the national reform agenda come from? Well, it came from Victoria, under the premiership of Steve Brax, and as I always remind, the head of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet in Canberra, Terry Moran, he played a significant role in that process. I remember him visiting Western Australia and saying, look, we want all the states to get together on this new agenda of cooperative federalism. It was initiated by the states. And in many ways, you could see it, I think, as a pragmatic response and yet a principled response to the depressing reality of creeping centralism. Why do I say pragmatic? Because it recognises vertical fiscal imbalance and it has reached the conclusion it's too hard a nut to crack. Much the pity, but that's the conclusion. A political assessment. It was to be a partnership approach to government and financing of government directed to promoting competition and participation in the interests of productivity. Now, in proposing this approach, Victoria and the other states drew on the experience of the national competition policy of the 1990s. There's no doubt this has been a great initiative in Australian politics. Certainly, if you support economic reform, if you don't support economic reform, you'd have to acknowledge that it's been a successful initiative. It's seen the Commonwealth and the states agree to changes required to improve productivity. However, each state was left free to determine the rate and pace of change. Despite the best efforts of the National Competition Council, the Potato Marketing Board of Western Australia is still alive and kicking. However, should the performance of the states not be viewed as acceptable by the National Competition Council, should be assessed as acceptable by the National Competition Council, they would receive incentive payments from the Commonwealth. This mixture of national purpose on the one side, better productivity, and state delivery on the other, through reforms to many of the utilities, reforms to the regulatory systems, this was a balance that really worked. And I think a lot of people underestimate the extent to which this system legitimised change in a way a unitary system could never have done it. Remember the stresses and strains associated with microeconomic reform in the 1990s. They were real, particularly in rural and regional areas. But because the state parliaments had to pass these reforms, including upper houses, some of which, in the case of my own state, highly malapportioned towards rural and regional interests, it had to be debated in the community. It couldn't just be taken from the centre and just applied without consultation. And I think this was a very, very important part of the process by giving legitimacy to change that would not have been there in a unitary system. So I think what happened, even then there was a lot of resistance to that change process. But it was successful. So the states realised, look, they could play a role in these reform processes. They could preserve their autonomy. They could get some benefits from the Commonwealth through incentive payments. But they could genuinely participate in what was a national issue, i.e., in that time, productivity through competition. Now, as Australia entered the new century, it became clear that this economic challenge was also a social challenge, particularly in health, education, and social welfare generally. A healthier, more skilled, and better motivated population was needed to bring about further productivity improvement. Given that both Commonwealth and state governments had responsibilities in these areas, it was clear that a new partnership would be created. Would be required. About the new financial and operational arrangements which have emerged from the Council of Australian Governments post-2007, to facilitate this national reform agenda, I want to say two things. Firstly, that the model is very coherent. It's coherent in construction and it's also intellectually sound in its conception. Outcomes are distinguished from outputs. What we want from government activity is distinguished from what governments do. The roles and responsibilities of each level of government are to be agreed and stated. Performance indicators and benchmarks are set to judge the performance, and a Council of Australian Governments Reform Council created to monitor and assess that performance. And I declare an interest in that I am the deputy chair of that council appointed by the states throughout the nation. So at the heart of this model is the idea that agreement over objectives doesn't necessarily mean uniformity over the means to achieve them. Indeed, the whole idea was to move away from the heavily regulated special purpose payment system to a system that allowed for local flexibility. What mattered was whether the outcomes were being achieved, not on how that was to be done. So, what emerged from this were from 90 special purpose payments, we went down to 5 agreements in health, education, skills and workforce development, disability services, affordable housing, and Indigenous reform. Simplification, reduction in complexity, payments to the states, monitoring of performance, and hopefully through the monitoring performance, a degree of political accountability would be put into play in the democratic process. The states loved it. Guaranteed revenue, devolution of responsibility, transparency to derive performance by way of public reporting of the results. This leads me to my second point. There was another part of the equation, national partnership payments, to facilitate or reward reforms of national importance. This leads to my second observation about the new system. The national partnership payments are paid to the states to deliver discrete projects or outputs, to do particular things. They're to have a limited time horizon, and if they are to be rewarded, reform will have to be accepted as having happened by the COAG Reform Council. In relation to the facilitation payments as opposed to the reward payments, they're only paid if certain things are done, deemed to be reforms of national significance. There are now a massive number of national partnership payments. Go to the website and you'll see them all. I tried to count them up yesterday, but I simply feel reluctant to give a figure in that it's probably expanded in the last 24 hours. They range from preventative health, early childhood education, the big one, the seamless national economy, homelessness, productivity places, and of course they're all coming out of this national reform agenda. The streamlining agreement has 36 streams of regulation and competition reform. So, this is the new system. brilliant in conception. What's actually happening out there? I'd say this system is alive, but how well is it? We need to go below the surface and look at the real dynamics of what's going on. Despite an aspiration to see a change in the culture of intergovernmental relations required to make this work, the players at both levels are reverting to type. For its part, the Commonwealth is finding it hard to accept this idea of federal balance and the diversity it brings. Old habits die hard. At the state level, they can't resist the temptation to take the money at any cost, despite misgivings about what is being required, what they're being required to spend that money on. Once again, highly restrictive and requirements and controls are coming back into the equation of Australian federalism. And they're coming back through the national partnership payments. And even in the big agreements like health and education, we should note that the Commonwealth moved beyond an outcome agenda to an output agenda. Two examples. The Commonwealth, of course, has required the states to set up hospital networks if they're to be funded under the new national agreement. Hospital networks may be a very good thing, but the proposal that was actually put by the Health Commission on this was the activity-based funding, and the states were to determine how to organise their hospital systems, and they would be accountable for that decision. On this occasion, the Commonwealth's gone from outcomes to required outputs, and that's now been agreed by all of the states, so they'll have to now go about the business of creating those networks. Victoria, of course, says they've already got them. They don't have to change anything. WA was initially resistant on that, and it'll be interesting to see where they take those networks. On education, we have a national curriculum. Well, we haven't got one yet. It's in the process of being created. Again, it's moving beyond outcomes. What we want from the education system to determining what's going to go into that system. So, national partnership payments, lots of them, huge amount of money involved, lots of controls being put into place by the Commonwealth, old habits returning to the system. In relation to the national agreements which replaced the special purpose payments, generally speaking, much more flexibility, but on key issues, the Commonwealth can't resist the temptation to go beyond an outcomes-based system to requiring the states to govern themselves and set up their public administration in a particular way. The concept of subsidiarity, which requires decisions to be handled at the least centralised level and not handed up to a higher level unless that's absolutely necessary, for example, in the defence of the nation, is as alien to the Commonwealth government and Commonwealth bureaucracy as socialism has become for the Labor Party. Nor is it necessarily understood by the states. Look at two areas. One, the way many of them deal with their own localities is just as oppressive as the Commonwealth's methods of dealing with the states. But more importantly, too often it's sacrificed by the states in their search for money from the Commonwealth. We saw how some of these stresses and strains were playing out in the Commonwealth Health Agreement. Only deft political work by Prime Minister Julia Gillard rescued that package. Note, however, that it's still an agreement. There's still a lot of work to be done. And I think it'll be a real test of the new system of federal-state relations to put the detail onto the agreement that's been entered into. The attitudes, the behaviour of the state and the Commonwealth public servants, the attitude, the values that are taken by the Commonwealth and state politicians will really be put under strain. And if they come out, I think it will be a great achievement for Australian federalism. However, what the health issue has demonstrated was the potential that does exist for the states to push their agenda, should they decide. Remember the conflict over the funding arrangements, where the GST, which of course was given to the states at the time of its introduction to try to give them a growth revenue, became an issue. And I think the Prime Minister's decision to take that off the table and to have a pool fund was certainly a much better resolution from the point of view of our federal system. Whilst it's clear then that the cooperative federalism, that cooperative federalism along the lines developed in recent years is the best way forward for the states in Australia today, it remains doubtful whether it can be fully institutionalised in a way that protects their long-term interests and autonomy. Attitudes and values within the Commonwealth may have moderated, but it's hard to say to see that they're fundamentally changed. Unless they do, cooperative federalism will be a good idea that didn't realise its potential to renew our federal system. The fundamental driver of Australian federalism, the financial power of the Commonwealth. Resources mean power. Power leads to temptation, and temptation leads to coercion and control. The only known remedy for that particular illness comes from checks and balances and a more equal distribution of resources. As I noted earlier, the states still have power and influence in the system, even if limited and declining. Certainly when we compare Australia with other nations. The model of cooperative federalism being proposed could work if backed up by a genuine effort to address vertical fiscal imbalance. The distribution of the GST to the states and territories was never going to be a successful resolution of this matter. In the first place, it's a Commonwealth tax. And as we saw last year, the temptation to claw it back is always strong. In the second place, we must remember that the GST replaced a range of state taxes, which were not as efficient or growth sensitive, but nevertheless they did raise revenue for state governments. The only lasting solution to this state of affairs would be to allow the states back into the field of income tax. For this to happen, the Commonwealth would need to cut income taxes across the board, thus making room for the states, who could then apply their own rate. Now, this idea was starting to get some currency in the early 1990s. The tax would still be administered and collected by the Commonwealth, but the states would have this growth revenue. What's the realistic possibility of such an item coming onto the agenda? Should such an issue be put on the table, it would require a further examination of Commonwealth and state roles and responsibilities. A big issue. Note also that it could open up a discussion of further tax reform and simplification at the state level, something the business community certainly want and have been advocating for some time. However, I'm reminded of what I said earlier about the politics of federalism in Australia. Why would the Commonwealth agree to such changes and give up power in the process? For this to happen, they would need to be convinced that it was a good idea. And even if some of their number were convinced it's a good idea, there is no doubt they would see strong opposition from their colleagues. I was looking through my file on federalism to prepare this lecture, and I found a newspaper article dated the 16th of November 1991, the Sydney Morning Herald, Mike Schekete. I miss his writing, and we don't get it so much these days. But Mike said this: Keating wrecks chances of a saner federation. And you would remember it. The jockeying for the position of leader of the Australian Labor Party. Bob Hawke hanging on in the process of trying to reform the federal system. Cliff Walsh and other academics had put forward the idea of sharing income tax. It was being taken up. Certainly, it was a very attractive proposal for the states. In Paul Keating's jockeying for the Prime Ministership, He attacked the whole idea of handing power back to the states. And of course, it scuttled the whole process. And his prime ministership, of course, changed direction on that issue. So we know that the politics of this are really tough. It requires someone to give up power that they already have. It requires that someone to give up power when a lot of their advisers have the culture and pride of what the Commonwealth does and see the other levels of government as lower and lesser beings. And you have then the politics within the parties themselves. For their part, the states could advocate such a change. And I remember making a speech on this subject at the time of the GST, arguing that the GST would not be a long-term solution for the states, but we needed this share of income tax. The states, however, have no constitutional arrangements to make it happen. Our Commonwealth, our constitution is such that the ability of the states to change it are virtually nil. So in relationship to this aspiration, I'm reminded of Darrell Kerrigan. Tell them they're dreaming, son. You'll remember that. So Australia seems destined to have a federal system that is at its best, second best. Our responsibilities in such a situation are to try to make that second best solution work as well as it can. That means the states being more forceful in defence of their interests and the Commonwealth more understanding of the complexity and benefits, the complexity of policy and the benefits of policy diversity. Is that really going to be possible in the adversarial system that has developed in our nation? And sadly, I have to conclude that I don't think it is. But I do believe we need to keep the idea of federalism before the mind of the electorate, keep it on the table as an issue, so when those propitious circumstances emerge, as they will do one day, we're ready to make the reform that really matters, and that is tackling vertical fiscal imbalance. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Gallup, for that very thought-provoking lecture. We do have a few minutes for questions, and if you do have a question, would you like to come to the microphone, please?
Yes. I have a question.
Yeah.
I wish to identify myself, a voter and a ratepayer.
Yeah.
Now, my direction is aimed at making the destiny of this Senate available as the voice of Australia. I'll repeat that.
Yes, this Senate. Remember, it's questions.
No, this is a question. This is my preliminary to the question. We have in Australia over 300 local governments plus. Now, my suggestion is this: their voice should be heard here in the Senate. So you have grassroots taxpayers and voters who have a voice here in this parliament, in this very house here. So I'm asking you, why hasn't the local government been able to find its voice here into the Senate so that the Senate, this is my question, so that the Senate can fulfil its destiny of being the voice of Australia?
Well, I think its destiny was to be the voice of the states, of course. But I think the problem with such a proposal in taking power away from the people to elect both houses of parliament, its democratic credentials, I think, would be difficult to... It would lack the democratic credentials, I think, to be advocated in our current system. If, on the other hand, the Senate changed its nature to be more like a House of Lords or something without a lot of power over finance and legislation, a checking but not an ultimate decision-making power, you might consider things like that. But under the current system, where we have proportional representation for the Senate, I think that encourages smaller parties, independents and minorities, and gives them a chance to influence outcomes from our system. So I prefer proportional representation as a way to do that rather than incorporating institutions into the electoral system.
Question over here, thanks.
Very quickly, I just could note your comments about bias at the beginning of your talk.
Yep.
You're a Western Australian and you were their chief for a number of years.
Yeah.
We all know that all Western Australians are secessionists. So is your talk a preparation for a declaration of independence? And have you come up with a name for your new country yet?
Well, you know, once upon a time I used to dream about the Democratic Socialist Republic of Western Australia, but... talk about chances of something happening. That certainly wouldn't. No, look, I think I favour federalism as opposed to secession. And subsidiarity also means that issues that can't be addressed at a local level ought to be addressed at a national level, and defence is a good case study. And as my good friend Kim Beazley said to me, you know, if those secessionists really want to carry through on it, they've got to work out how much money they're going to have to spend on defence. Now, I think we ought to advocate for federalism and... you know, as I always used to say, I'm an Australian first, a Western Australian, born and bred in Geraldton, you know, and we've got to try and merge all of those interests together through good systems of local government, good systems of state government, and a good federal government. So, no, I prefer federalism. There is a secessionist current in Western Australia. It's really not that strong. And I think it's the muscle flexing within the federation that we're going to see and have seen in the past, rather than a move towards secession. And let's face it, they voted for secession in the 1930s and then put in power, West Australians in the 30s put in power a party that was against it. So as my mentor John Wilden said to me when I went into politics, the late John Wilden, "Jeff, never assume rationality in politics."
Questioner over here, thanks.
Australia, or at least the components of the Australian Federation, are fairly culturally homogeneous.
Yep.
And that contrasts to Canada or Switzerland, where you've got cantons or provinces that are quite distinctive. What effect do you think that's had on the imbalance or the creation of the imbalance in our Federation?
Well, I think from an analytical point of view, there's no doubt that Canadian federalism is much stronger in the culture because of Quebec. No question about that, and you mentioned Switzerland, which is the, you know, the federal dream in a sense. So it's had an impact, but I wouldn't over-exaggerate it, because I think what we see is that political systems create their own cultures, if you like. And I use the illustration, I mean, and I'm quite proud of the fact that Western Australia does not have poker machines. And you know, it's strongly supported in the community. And it just makes a difference. I'm not so sure about daylight saving and trading hours, but, you know, we or the Potato Marketing Board for that matter. But nevertheless, I think these are differences. You know, New South Wales has gone out there with its drug policy, medically supervised injecting centre. Victoria and those have gone out there with their charters of rights. We create a dynamic as well as reflect a dynamic. And I think, yes, Canadian federalism a lot healthier than Australian federalism. That being said, I don't think we should exaggerate the impact that cultural uniformity has as a precondition and driving force for centralisation.
One more question over here, thanks.
Adrian Rollins from the Financial Review. The Grants Commission has come out today with an update on the distribution of the GST revenue between the states. And in the inevitable way of these things, there is a league table of winners and losers out of the current round, and... the losers of this time seem to be Victoria, and the winners are Western Australia and Queensland. And I was just wondering, this sort of approach to managing the GST revenue take and the institution of a Grants Commission itself to handle this, what do you make of that process?
Well, look, you know, the Grants Commission has, you know, I think a very, very... has played a very, very key role in Australian history. You know, obviously had different names and in earlier times, but it has brought an equalising influence to Australian politics. It's never easy to find a formula that's precise that will, for example, be able to reflect the fact that in Western Australia, even though there's revenue coming in, there's also great demands on infrastructure to back up that growth that's occurring. Or that, you know, in Sydney, there is Western Sydney, which I, having now living in Sydney before, that was, I didn't know about Western Sydney. But it is huge and it has great needs associated with it. But I think the issue with the Grants Commission is, you know, we certainly put forward a proposal from Western Australia that we needed to take more account of our infrastructure needs. The Commonwealth has come along some way to that with its infrastructure fund and to say that we will support the states and if they put forward proposals that are nationally significant, we'll back them up. But in the end, a lot of those funds become, like all of these things, subject to, you know, trying to get a little bit there and a little bit there so everyone's happy, rather than really looking at what would be nationally significant. So the GST distribution process through the Grants Commission is not perfect, but I do think we need one. The principle I agree with. In recent years, it has tended to work against Western Australia because of the royalty growth that's been there. There's some correction now going on. I think the real issue is sharing taxes. And the proposal that was put forward in the last years of the Hawke government to create some space so the tax rate could be set by each state, that would give them real growth revenue. And I think that their ability to blame the Commonwealth would be radically reduced in that situation. So that's a roundabout way. I think Grants Commission we need to try to equalise out opportunities throughout the country. The formula is always subject to a lot of debate. It was certainly our view when I was in government that it didn't quite reflect the infrastructure demands in a place like Western Australia. But the real issue, I think, for states would be this income tax sharing. But, you know, as I said, it's very hard to get that up.
Well, sadly, our time is up. Thank you all very much for coming today. And Professor Gallop, thank you for a terrific lecture. You've set a very high benchmark for the rest of the year. But please join me in thanking Professor Jeff Gallop.